that morning light exposure will anchor the timing of the body's clock earlier in the day. And what that will mean is that it will tend to shift their sleep timing earlier too, provided that late in the day, they systematically reduce their exposure to that type of light. So perhaps beginning 2 hours before their planned bedtime, if these people can dim the lights if they're indoors or turn off some lights, or they could wear blue blocking glasses, and if possible, also reduce their use of devices at this time, then they'll be able to shift their clocks earlier, go to bed earlier, and then if that's coupled with not using an alarm clock in the morning, all of a sudden they can get more sleep and experience some of those benefits that I mentioned.
This is the Energy Motto Podcast, a show for the youth, for the curious, and for those seeking to discover more about their inner and outer world.
We are bringing on the experts, guides, and leaders that are shaping the path to an exciting era.
And we are your hosts, Emilio Ortiz
and Alvaro Jodar. Today we present a sport and exercise scientist with a doctorate in sleep, nutrition, and metabolism, with incredible research in discrete pillars in our health, like environmental exposure or relationships. He's also a coach, personal trainer, sports massage therapist, you name it. He's held performance for strength and power athletes, whether it's the U.S. Naval Special Warfare Command or the Atlantic rowing team who broke the world record. He brought out innumerable tips on improving sleep, enhancing our performance, and living a better lifestyle. So once again, thank you all for listening to this podcast and helping it grow, and most importantly, Dr. Greg Potter. Mr. Greg Potter, Dr. Greg Potter, how are you doing today?
I'm very well. How are you guys?
Doing great. Wanted to jump right in and ask you a little bit about, you know, your story, how you've come to becoming such a unique sleep scientist and everything. So
take it away. I wouldn't describe myself as a unique sleep scientist, maybe unique in that I'm quite weird compared to a lot of people. But how did I get into this stuff? I became interested in improving my own health and performance when I was 12. I got injured playing rugby, and that coincided with an age at which I also became interested in girls, and I wanted to look better for those girls, and I also wanted to get over my back pain. And I spent most of my time at school spending my free time finding out about nutrition and exercise and how to use those things to improve my performance on the sports field and to gain muscle and lose fat. And over time, that developed into a more general interest in how all different components of lifestyle affect how we perform and feel each day and our risk of various chronic diseases. And that culminated in me first doing a degree in sport and exercise science at Loughborough University, and then doing a master's degree in exercise physiology, and eventually a PhD, which focused on the intersection between sleep, biological rhythms, nutrition, and metabolism. And since then, I've worked in various different roles. I worked as content director, creating things like blogs and online courses for a company named humanos.me. But now I work as a consultant for individuals and groups of people to help them perform better. And this year I co-founded a company named Resilient Nutrition, which is a food product and supplement company that aims to make products that make feeling and performing better simple and delicious. And I function as chief science officer for that company. So that's a little bit about me.
It's fascinating. I wanted to ask you, because your background, it's really interesting, and you grew up, you're very interested in sports science and things like this, because I've heard you coached a sprinter to 4 gold medals at European championships. Why did you decide to go towards the route of performance and optimization?
Well, when you read in my bio that I coached a sprinter to 4 gold medals, one thing that you should recognize is that that was in his particular category.
Yeah.
And he has a condition that basically means that he's not performing among the elite sprinters of the world. And he specifically has autism. So it's probably not as impressive a coaching feat as it might sound. Mm-hmm. But with that said, I became interested in sprinting specifically because when I got to Loughborough University, which is really a hotbed of coaching and sports performance in the UK, it was, for example, the home for the Great Britain training preparation for the 2012 Olympics when I was at university there. Because of that, I wanted to spend time learning from great coaches. And the first place that I went was the athletics track. And I began shadowing a coach there. And after a few months, was asked if I wanted to have my own stable of sprinters and began with working with university sprinters. And along the way, acquired some more elite sprinters too. And so really it was serendipity that got me into that in particular. And I loved working with those athletes, and I still work with various athletes now. I've done some work recently with a couple of guys who rode the Atlantic. I'm currently working with a lady who's getting ready to single-handedly sail around the planet later this year. And wow. I'm also helping a lady who's getting ready to run from John O'Groats to Land's End, basically covering the entire distance of the United Kingdom in about 18 days in a few weeks' time, and might also be helping another guy get ready to do some pretty phenomenal feats of running. But with that said, I became increasingly interested in how to help people improve their health, because when I was working with athletes, I felt that this is good fun and I enjoy seeing their progress and I enjoy feeling like I'm contributing to them realizing their goals. But at the same time, in my career, I'd like to do as much good as possible. And I feel that I'm better able to do that by helping people ward off chronic diseases by using lifestyle interventions, which are as inexpensive as possible and which scale as effectively as possible. And so while working one-on-one with people is very interesting and I think helps me be a better practitioner, I don't want to spend too much of my time doing that because it takes time away from doing things that can help more people, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it makes complete sense. That's a tough call, you know, switching, you know, and doing, you know, your own thing with resilient nutrition and, you know, actually, you know, making a big impact rather than just a few individuals. I wanted to ask specifically on those individuals that you're coaching, when regarding sleep, do they need the 8 hours? Do they need more? Because I've heard maybe a very strange fact that Roger Federer, for example, would sleep like 10 hours every day, things like this. Compared to a normal person, does an athlete have to sleep more?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. And my short response would be that I think much of the time athletes will need slightly more sleep than the general population. But the reality is that in particular for the people with whom I work, much of the time these people can't actually sleep that long. So take the instance of Max and Dave, who rode the Atlantic and finished that earlier this year. They were rowing in 2-hour shifts every day for about 37 days. So at a given time, the longest they would have been able to sleep in a consolidated block was probably about an hour and 50 minutes. But I doubt very much that any of them slept that long at one time over the course of their 37 days. So just wanted to throw that in there. But with that said, I think when athletes who sleep relatively well are able to extend their time in bed and thereby get more sleep, they're likely to experience lots of different positive effects on performance. Mm-hmm. And this was first shown in 2011 by a researcher at Stanford University and she took the Stanford University men's varsity basketball team. And for 6 weeks, the players aimed to get at least 10 hours in bed each day. So that's both overnight and including naps. And what she found was that while the players extended their sleep, their reaction times improved. They were able to run a multi-directional sprint faster. Their free throw accuracy and three-point field goal percentages both improved. Mm-hmm. And since then, there have been other studies showing improvements on other motor skills too. So for example, there's been some work on tennis players showing that after a week of getting more sleep, the players serve more accurately. And we're talking about meaningful improvements in their serving accuracy.
Wow.
Sort of 6% improvement, something like that. And with that said, I think the important takeaway for people is that if they are able to prolong their time in bed and they're currently sleeping well, then doing what they can to get more time in bed while retaining their sleep quality is likely to benefit them. And what are some ways of doing that? Well, for one, people might try and minimize their use of alarm clocks in the morning. Mm-hmm. Another important factor is removing consumption of certain things that might interfere with the depth and duration of their sleep. And caffeine is an obvious example of those. So when people can temporarily go without caffeine for a period of time, they're likely to sleep slightly longer and certainly sleep deeper and more efficiently too. And when I say efficiently, what I mean is that if you look at their time in bed, they're likely to be asleep for a higher proportion of that time in bed after they reduce their caffeine intake. And that sleep efficiency is important to the restorative effects of sleep.
Yeah.
And then one other thing that I think people can benefit from if they're trying to extend their sleep is shifting their body's clocks slightly earlier. And the body's clock controls all sorts of different things, but one of the things that it influences is the timing of sleep. And it's primarily set by our patterns of exposure to light. And specifically, if people get more high intensity, short wavelength light, so the type of light that you get outside on a sunny day, early in their waking day, so let's say within a couple of hours of waking up in the morning, then that morning light exposure will anchor the timing of the body's clock earlier in the day. And what that will mean is that it will tend to shift their sleep timing earlier too, provided that late in the day, they systematically reduce their exposure to that type of light. So perhaps beginning 2 hours before their planned bedtime, if these people can dim the lights if they're indoors or turn off some lights, or they could wear blue blocking glasses, and if possible, also reduce their use of devices at this time, then they'll be able to shift their clocks earlier, go to bed earlier. And then if that's coupled with not using an alarm clock in the morning, all of a sudden they can get more sleep and experience some of those benefits that I mentioned.
Yeah, absolutely. And when you're talking about sleep efficiency, would you say that that means we can shorten the amount of time that we sleep? Do you recommend for young adults, for example, to sleep 8 hours? For me, I feel more comfortable sleeping more. I don't know if that's because I sleep inefficiently or because I just need 9 hours. Things like this, I'm so...
Yeah. The amount of sleep that a person needs is specific to that person. And it's somewhat trait-like, by which I mean that there are genuinely short sleepers among us, people who only need about 6 hours of sleep. And then other people need more sleep. And the amount of sleep that each of us needs does also vary over the course of the lifespan. You're both young guys. Okay. And what you tend to find is that when somebody is first born, they need lots of sleep, but their sleep isn't especially consolidated. And it doesn't follow a very clear pattern, at least for the first few weeks of life. But then over time, it becomes more regular. And as young people, we need a lot of sleep. And then in general, over the course of the lifespan, especially when somebody reaches physical maturity, the amount of sleep that people get on average will tend to decline over time. So whereas as a 20-year-old, let's say, you might need 9 hours of sleep per night, you might find that later in life, by the age of 70, you're only spending 7.5 hours asleep each night. So the goal should be to get as much sleep as you need by removing those barriers to getting enough sleep that I mentioned, while also retaining high quality of sleep. And sleep quality is important, as are several other dimensions of sleep. And I think a lot of people tend to focus on sleep duration in particular. And that's a bit short-sighted because sleep timing seems to be important. So when each of us sleeps relative to when our body's clocks promote sleep, think of shift workers, for instance, who get in after a night shift and they arrive home right at the time at which they would actually normally be waking up in the morning. They're going to find it really hard to sleep well following that night shift. And there are other dimensions too that are important. So I mentioned sleep efficiency, but that's really one component of sleep quality, which also comprises other things like how well you feel you slept, so your subjective experience of sleep, and how restored you feel the day after sleep. And then there's the regularity of sleep. So it seems that people who have more regular sleep, so similar bedtimes from one day to the next, have better health than people who have more variable sleep. So it's really the interaction of all of these different dimensions of sleep health that determines how somebody's sleep affects them.
Yeah, Greg, I wanted to ask you a question because it's something that's always been very curious to me is people that have insomnia or maybe some illnesses that they can't like really fall asleep. Why or what have you come across in your research or in your studies that is indicating where this comes from and why people, like I have some people that tell me I just can't sleep at night. Like I'll fall asleep and then in an hour I'll wake up. Why do you think that happens, or what can we do to solve that as well?
So I think the causes of insomnia are, like most things, person specific. And what you tend to find is that there is some sort of genetic predisposition to insomnia in people who have this type of struggle. And maybe they go for decades without having any sleep issues, but then there's some sort of inciting event that all of a sudden unmasks that predisposition to insomnia, and they develop it for the first time. And then as they struggle with their sleep, they'll learn some negative sleep-related behaviors that will then perpetuate their sleep problems. But regarding what some of those things that cause sleep problems are, it could be all sorts of things. So it could, for example, be a stressful life event. And I think this is very relevant to many of us right now, because it seems that during the COVID-19 pandemic, sleep quality has in general deteriorated among most people. And with that said, I think that sorry, I just completely lost my train of thought. I might have just had a stroke. I didn't sleep last night, clearly. No, but seriously, so you have those types of stressful events that will lead to sleep problems.
Yeah.
But then also there might be some comorbid medical conditions that will lead to problems. And an example of that is some sort of psychiatric issue. So a lot of people who have depression or experience anxiety will find that their sleep moves somewhat in lockstep with their psychological health. And sometimes people will experience insomnia arising from the use of medications to cope with some of these issues. So commonly, for example, antidepressants will lead to disrupted sleep, specifically the selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors tend to disrupt sleep. And then another thing to consider is that, as you mentioned, people struggle with their sleep in different ways. Some people find it hard to fall asleep at the start of the night. Other people find it hard to sleep through the night. Other people have difficulties because they wake up very early in the morning, much earlier than they would like to wake, ideally. Mm-hmm. And the causes of these different types of so-called sleep phenotypes are not necessarily that well understood, but the ways that you help people with these different types of sleep problems do tend to differ. And that's probably actually most relevant to giving people medication to cope with these different types of sleep problems, but that's not something that we need to go into now. Mm-hmm. So that's a bit of background, but what I just say is that the causes are manifold, and they include some sort of genetic predisposition, some sort of inciting factor, and then some changes in behaviors that basically exacerbate their sleep problems over time. And so when it comes to helping these people, you need to start by thoroughly going through their sleep history and their current lifestyle, and then working out what some small changes they can make are that are likely to be A, effective in improving their sleep, B, easy for them to implement, and then C, likely to positively affect lots of other sleep-related behaviors too. So you're looking for the smallest, easiest change that's going to have the most positive knock-on effects on other aspects of behavior and health.
Okay, okay. That's incredible. I wanted to, you know, dive a little bit deeper on, as you said, the lifestyle that many of these people with insomnia might have, and maybe the lifestyle that many of us might have as well, whether it was taking this medication or just living in a post-industrialized world where we have the urban noise, where we have, you know, screens, artificial light. How is it different to back to living in the wild, or how is it better or worse? Because I'm sure there's both spectrums.
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. And I think we have to speculate about how it is different from how it was way back when, of course. But with that said, I think that we can make some informed guesses that are likely to be accurate. So if you think in the context of evolution, then we evolved in the presence of predictable changes in the environment, the most obvious of which is the 24-hour light-dark cycle. And then in response to this, we evolved these biological clocks that I mentioned, which basically program our biology according to time of day to optimize our bodies for different things at different times of day. And in the case of humans, as daytime active organisms, we're optimized for physical activity and food intake during the daytime, and then sleeping and fasting at night. But during industrialization, what happened is that Edison invented the incandescent light bulb in the late 1870s, and all of a sudden people could engage in behaviors at times of day that weren't consistent with how people evolved to behave. And that was coupled with changes in the transportation and production of food, which meant that all of a sudden people could also eat food and not need to be so active to get food, and they could eat that food round the clock. Couple that with some other environmental changes that would have increased things like environmental noise and pollution, and all of a sudden many people's lifestyles became uncoupled from those of our distant ancestors. And this third clock, the so-called social clock, influenced our lives more and more. And I mentioned shift workers earlier, but they are a very relevant example of how this social clock and how some of these more unnatural behaviors can disrupt our lifestyles and negatively affect health, because shift workers are disposed to developing numerous chronic diseases. And obviously that depends on the nature of the shift work and the individual, but those findings are quite consistent. So
yeah, I think the social clock.
I think that underlies many of the different issues that people now face. And so the question is, how can we try to return to conditions that somewhat mimic those of our distant ancestors. And when I think about what would be relatively ideal for humans, I think back to the time before agriculture, which probably first began maybe 12 to 13,000 years ago, something like that. And the reason is that humans have been around for 300,000 odd years. And so 12,000 years is the blink of an eye in the context of evolution. So if for most of the time that humans have existed on the planet, we lived as hunter-gatherers and we weren't consuming lots of post-agricultural revolution or post-Neolithic foods, then it's likely that we are best suited to consuming the different foods that were around back then. But with that said, we now have these modern lifestyles and certain comforts that I think make it possible for us to maybe actually sleep better and be more healthy than these people once were. So, for example, if you think of the sleep environment, then hundreds of thousands of years ago, people were probably group sleeping out in the wild, and they would have been alert to different noises in the environment, which might have indicated potential threats to them, for instance. And temperature cycles would have disrupted their sleep. And now we can shelter ourselves from some of those disturbances. We can optimize the temperature of our bedrooms. We can drown out extraneous noise. And we sleep in very comfortable beds too. So I think that it's possible for sleep to be more restorative now. It's just that nowadays we also face a bunch of stresses that we didn't have back then. And they often conspire to interfere with our sleep. And foremost among those is work-related stress, and probably as of the last few months, a few other stresses too. So things like financial stress for lots of people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How directly correlated do you think that the stress that we're going through in our day-to-day lives affects the quality of our sleep? Or what can you speak upon that subject and how we can minimize the stress we're dealing with in our environment in order to optimize our sleep?
So I think that they're probably strongly related to each other. But what I'll say is that it's likely difficult to understand the relationship between stress and sleep, because stress is a very subjective thing. Mm-hmm. Something that's stressful to one person, somebody else might find in some way beneficial. And so people have categorized stress into different buckets. So you have eustressors, which are stressors that lead to some sort of beneficial adaptation subsequently. So think of exercise, for instance, or fasting, or use of saunas. All of those things are acutely very stressful. But if they are dosed and timed appropriately, then they trigger biological defense mechanisms that better prepare our bodies to cope with subsequent stresses. But then at the other end of the spectrum, in a different bucket, there is distress, which is what most people commonly refer to as stress. And over time, it's this type of distress that accumulates to lead to health problems. And over the course of my so far short career, I increasingly feel like stress is the thing that underlies most health problems that people face. And I think that when people can do things to better cope with stress and to reduce their stress as much as possible, all different aspects of the health and performance are likely to benefit. So what are some of those things in relation to sleep specifically? I think for people who have insomnia, for example, some cognitive therapies can be very helpful. When you're helping somebody who has insomnia, you typically help them via two different categories of intervention. So one of these is behavioral changes. And this commonly includes things like sleep hygiene changes that many of the listeners will be familiar with. And that can be things like changing your patterns of exposure to light, capping your caffeine intake at a certain time of day, reducing late night alcohol intake, exercising early in the day. And a lot of people do those things quite well already. And so when you're helping people have insomnia, you tend to use some slightly more potent interventions. And One of those that's particularly effective that I'll mention here is something named stimulus control of behavior. And the idea here is very simple, and that's just that certain stimuli predictably trigger us to behave in certain ways. And this is because our brains are very good at creating associations between things. So for example, a lot of people will walk through their kitchens and mindlessly wander to the fridge, and all of a sudden they will find themselves eating something out of the jar in the fridge without actually even realizing that they're doing that. And it's because they've learned to associate the fridge with being somewhere you can acquire food.
It's so unconscious now.
Yeah. It is.
Don't even 100%. Think about it. Uh-huh.
Yeah, exactly. And this is a tangential, but mindful eating interventions are very helpful for people, especially for people who have obesity, and they tend to help reduce problematic eating behaviors, including binge type eating. But that's an aside. So the way that this relates to sleep is that if you have somebody who's struggling with their sleep, then what you'll tend to find is that they'll spend more and more time in bed in the hope that they will get a bit more sleep to catch up on the sleep that they feel they've been missing out on. Mm-hmm. The problem is that they'll end up spending a greater proportion of their time in bed awake, and their brains will learn to associate their bed, which is the stimulus, mm-hmm. with being awake, which is the behavior. And so for people who have insomnia, what they need to do is A, only go to bed when they're actually sleepy. B, if they wake up at night and they can't get back to sleep within 15 minutes or so, they should leave their beds and go and do something relaxing in a different room, such as reading a book in dim lighting or meditating, or perhaps even watching TV in dim lighting. You basically want to do something which is relaxing and in some way appealing, but not so engaging as to make you want to stay up for ages doing that activity.
That's a really big insight, because just a little talking about college students in general, for me, in my experience, in the beginning, I was always in my dorm room or whatever, and I was watching a Netflix show in my bed. And as we were saying, like, we start to associate that with certain things, like, that are not related to sleep. So that's a really big insight, and thank you for talking about that.
Yeah, and I spent far too long at university. Mm-hmm. I was there for 8 years, and for most of my time at university, I was in one room in which I studied and in which I slept and in which I watched TV and so on. Mm-hmm. And for people who have never had any sleep problems, that's not really a problem. And so I don't want to sound as if I'm adamant that people only do certain things in certain places. People shouldn't worry about their sleep if they're already sleeping well. And I think it's a problem when people overfixate on their sleep, as shown by a rise in so-called orthosomnia, in which people obsessively track their sleep and try and optimize their sleep in the hope of gaining all the benefits of sleep, but then ironically actually make their sleep worse. So I think you're showing your Aura ring right now.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. So the Apple Watch, the Aura.
Yeah, classic. So with that said, the one other thing that I think is important that's relevant to the stimulus control of behavior for people who have insomnia and for people who otherwise struggle with their sleep is to save their bed for sex and sleep only. Mm-hmm. But something I want to mention also is that this is relevant to most of our different health behaviors. So think, for example, of exercise. If you exercise at a gym, you'll probably find it really easy to exercise when you get to the gym. You don't even think about it. And the reason is the stimulus control of behavior. You have associated the gym with being somewhere where you exercise. But during lockdown, a lot of people all of a sudden had to exercise elsewhere. And for many people, we found ourselves exercising at home.
Yeah.
And that was quite tricky because we're not used to doing that at home. So the thing to understand is that you can apply this stimulus control of behavior principle to lots of different health behaviors. Mm-hmm. So in the context of physical activity, if you are locked down right now, you can designate a space in your environment, so in your flat or in your house or in your room, which you only use for exercise. And this is also relevant to eating. I mentioned eating at the fridge earlier. If you're on a weight loss diet and you find yourself prone to mindless eating, then maybe you commit to only eating when you're sat at the dinner table while not watching TV. Because that way you're going to actually focus on your food and recognize your body's internal sensations of hunger and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So that's another tip. And then just to throw in a couple more, I mentioned cognitive therapies, and there are a few of these that are very relevant. I think one that's helpful for lots of people who are very busy is making a to-do list about 2 hours or so before bedtime. Maybe you tack that on to the end of your dinner. The idea is just to list out everything you need to get done the next day in as much detail as is necessary. And if you do that, then you will offload those thoughts from your mind. And that way, when you go to bed, you are less likely to ruminate about everything that you need to get done the next day.
Mm-hmm.
And if you do that, then I generally suggest that people use a physical diary for that. So pen and paper or pencil and paper. But at the same time, I always feel a bit reluctant to say that because I am aware of the use of paper. And I think environmentally, that's a problem. So make of that what you will, but the principle remains. And if you do that, then you want to keep the physical diary by your bedside at night in case you wake up during the night
mm-hmm.
and realize that you forgot to list something that you need to get done the next day. And then one more is to list your worries. This sounds funny, but when people schedule worry time, if they are particularly anxious at the moment, they're likely to benefit. And I think the best time to do this is around dinner time. The reason is that a lot of people are very busy during the day
mm-hmm.
and that busyness will suppress their concerns. But then as they take their foot off the accelerator towards the end of the day, some of those worries will tend to come to the surface. And during this exercise, what you'll do is list the worry that you have, and then in an adjacent column, list the next step that you can do to address that concern. And you might find that there's nothing you can do to act on it. So maybe your concern is a global one. Maybe you're worried about whether there will be a vaccine developed by a certain time this year because you have a grandfather and you can't really act on that. And that's okay. And if that's the case, then I just suggest that you list the concern, and then in the adjacent column, you say, well, I can't really do anything about that. But at least through doing this type of writing exercise, you're likely to help get it out of your head.
Yeah.
And then finally, one tool that's very helpful for a lot of people that has risen in popularity a lot in recent years is mindfulness training. So I think a mindfulness meditation practice can be very helpful. Mindfulness-based stress reduction approaches mm-hmm. have repeatedly been shown to help people who have stress-related sleep problems. Mm-hmm. And there are lots of apps that are available that can be helpful. And I think for most people, scheduling time at the start of the waking day makes a lot of sense because people generally have a bit more control over their time at that time of day. And just setting aside 10 minutes for that each morning and ingraining that habit can be very conducive to sleeping better. And my favorite app is Sam Harris's app, Waking Up, but there are lots of different apps out there. And I just think that when people are starting out with a practice, it makes sense to have somebody give them meditation pointers, but then they might find that over time, they don't need the app anymore once they have the basic meditation skills. And mm-hmm. if they just set an alarm for 10 minutes, then they can sit unguided and get some of those same benefits.
Wow, those are great tips, brother. Thank you so much. I wanted to ask you also, we're talking about the topic of these people that are really keen to track their sleep and stuff like this. For example, I was showing my Oura Ring, which is just a little ring I wear to tell me how efficient I'm sleeping, my heart rate variability during the night. But I want to ask you, like, what are your thoughts on that? And it's really like a biohacking culture thing to track, to optimize, to self-experiment. But do you think that these technologies can go into like the mass market and more people can start adapting these technologies to start really tracking their sleep? And why should we track in the first place? A lot of people ask me And sometimes I don't really know what to answer. It's just like, I want to know, you know, like I want to know how well I slept, but why should we track it? That's my question, I guess.
Yeah. I could give you a really long answer here. I won't. Yeah. But first, regarding why people should track, I don't think that everybody should track anything necessarily, but I think that it's very helpful, and it's particularly helpful when people are trying to change a behavior. Susan Mickey is a scientist at UCL in London, and she has a behavior change framework named the behavior change wheel. And she's done much of the research on the science of how to change health behaviors. And a few years ago, she published a systematic review of all the different interventions that are used to help people change things like their diets and their physical activity. And what she found was that of all of the different behavior change techniques that are out there, self-monitoring or tracking is in general the most potent. This is very specific on the context, but it's really helpful. I think people intuitively understand this. If you want to smoke fewer cigarettes, then tracking your consumption of said cigarettes is going to make you more aware of your consumption and help you reduce it. And in relation to sleep, sleep tracking is very helpful for people who have sleep problems. I don't necessarily think that it's helpful for people who sleep fine, but if I'm working with somebody who has insomnia, then what we'll typically do is track their sleep for the first 1 to 2 weeks to establish what their sleep is like at baseline. And that will help me identify some of the contributors to their sleep. So maybe we find out, for example, that they're consuming 4 filter coffees a day, the last of which is at 2 PM, and they're going to bed at 9 PM. Mm-hmm. And that is contributing to their difficulty falling asleep. But the sleep diary will also provide some other helpful data. So it will give me an indication of how long they're actually asleep each evening, their sleep efficiency, their subjective sleep quality, and so on. Mm-hmm. And all of that will inform the guidance that I then give that person. And when I'm helping people who have insomnia, I tend to use a sleep diary named the Consensus Sleep Diary. And I can't currently find a good online version of that. So I've just made my own Excel version of it that I use with people. But that is what I tend to use personally for these people. Now, with that said, I think that for the general population who are just interested in being a bit healthier, tracking other health behaviors can definitely be handy. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned earlier about whether this type of self-monitoring is likely to break into the mainstream. I think we've already seen that to a degree. If you look at data on use of wearables, then there has been a marked change in the use of those devices in the last few years. I remember going to a conference about sleep during my PhD in 2015. And one of the presenters was there wearing a Fitbit. And during his presentation, he asked about how many people were tracking sleep at the time. And he was speaking to a large auditorium full of sleep scientists, and 3 people raised their hands. Wow. In 2020, if the context was the same, then I suspect that 90% of people would raise their hands, probably 70 to 90%. Yeah. So there's definitely been a surge in uptake of those devices. And I think that they're most helpful for most people at the moment in monitoring their physical activity. And the reason is that during the last few months in particular, a lot of us have become more sedentary. Fitbit published some data on their device use patterns worldwide, comparing what they found in March of this year to what they found at the same time last year. And in countries throughout Europe, they found that in some places, people's step counts had declined by over 30%, which is no great surprise. Yeah. But the point is that when we're locked down and we can maybe get out of the house once a day or not at all, we're being more sedentary. And when you wear one of these devices that gives you information about things like your step count, for many people, that makes the behavior more salient and leads them to get more steps each day, which is really important to their overall health. And physical activity is very relevant to sleep too, because what you tend to find is that if you take somebody who's quite inactive and you have them begin a training program or just increase their physical activity, then they'll tend to fall asleep a bit faster, sleep slightly longer, and experience slightly higher quality sleep. Yeah. So I think that tracking physical activity is helpful for pretty much everyone. You don't need to do it the whole time, but do it periodically. And you don't need a wearable for this necessarily. You could just do so by keeping your phone in your pocket. And if you do that, then I suggest that you keep your phone on airplane mode. So I think that's very relevant to lots of people. But then there are many instances in which tracking specific outcomes can be also quite helpful. So for example, if you're an athlete and you're trying to monitor how your readiness to train is changing over time, then looking at resting heart rate or resting pulse rate and heart rate or pulse rate variability can tell you something about your total so-called allostatic load, the amount of stress that you're under and how your body is responding to that stress. And if you are very informed, then I think that you can use those data to optimize your training program, although I think that's not necessarily that easy to do. But the point is that most people will realize that if their resting pulse rate is up 6 beats a minute compared to what has been for several months previously, they should probably try and do what they can to reduce their stress. So that's a longer answer than I planned, but those are some of the first things that come to mind. And I think the takeaway for people should be, if you have some sort of sleep problem and insomnia in particular, then monitoring your sleep for at least a couple of weeks at a time periodically, maybe 3 to 4 times a year, can be helpful. And if you do have that type of problem, then I think you should see a specialist. And if you find out that you have insomnia, then there are lots of different online programs that are effective in helping people have insomnia. And the one that I like most is called Sleepio, which is S-L-E-E-P-I-O. So start there. But if you're a good sleeper, don't worry about tracking your sleep. And instead, consider the fact that if you use one of these devices during the daytime, then you can find out more about your patterns of physical activity. And maybe you just use these devices at times at which you feel like you're going to be more likely to be less physically active than normal. And that's personally what I do. If, for example, I change my environment, so if I move house or move flat, then for the first couple of weeks that I move into the new location, I'll tend to wear a device at this time, because that way I'll get a sense of how many steps a given walking route requires, for instance. Yeah. And then when I have a sense of that, after a couple of weeks, I'll often just remove the device because I'll have a rough idea of how physically active I'm being. So it's always person specific. It depends what you're trying to optimize. They definitely have their place, and people don't need to go out and spend a fortune on these devices. I think in many instances, smartphones do actually suffice.
I love that. I love that idea of doing the wearables for a couple of weeks. For me, they overwhelm me already. My phone already overwhelms me with data. So I like that. I wanted to ask a little bit on the other spectrum of people that don't track anything, that might have their social clocks much more delayed. Like people our age might, you know, sleep 10, 11 hours with alcohol consumption, waking up extremely late, you know, noon or past that.
Skipping class.
So what do you recommend? How can people adapt to having a good circadian rhythm, having a good clock, while at the same time be able to, probably not too often, but be able to consume alcohol, or be able to go out, you know,
and have a social life.
Exactly.
Yeah. So what I'd preface this by saying is that with all of these health behaviors, I think the goal should be to be somebody who has a healthy lifestyle most of the time. And then on those occasions when your lifestyle isn't so healthy, don't worry about it. And I realized that just saying don't worry about it isn't very helpful, but I think that people will understand my point. Yeah. And there's an old saying, which is, it's better to eat the so-called wrong food with the right attitude than the right food with the wrong attitude. And I think that that's very relevant here. So if you go out with your mates for a few beers and you stay up until 2 a.m. and you do that once a week and you're 21, I think that's absolutely fine. And I think that you should do that. So crack on. But with that said, the rest of the time, I think doing what you can to support your health is smart. And with respect to going to bed very late, I mentioned earlier that sleep duration tends to change over the course of the lifespan. Sleep timing, of course, does too. And people are typically at their latest around the end of adolescence. So maybe at around age 19 for girls and 21 for boys. And
we sleep more? Is that what you said?
No, like duration? You sleep later.
Okay.
At that time. So you're at your latest around the end of adolescence. Mm-hmm. And what that means is that it's perfectly natural for people of that age to go to bed a bit later. The problem is that it seems that these individuals are also more sensitive to the body clock delaying effects of some exposures like light at night. So if you take somebody who's 20 and you expose them to some sort of strong blue lighting an hour before they would normally go to bed, and you compare their response to somebody who's 70, then you'd find that in the younger person, the strong blue light would shift their sleep later to a greater degree than it would shift the sleep of the older person, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And so for these people, what I'd say is circle back to what we spoke about when extending sleep in athletes earlier. It's really important that you increase your morning light exposure when possible. So within a couple of hours of waking up in the morning, if you can, get outside if it's daylight. If you can't get outside, then I think a so-called bright light therapy lamp can be very helpful. And I just get one that emits at least 10,000 lux. There are lots of different devices that are out there. I like a brand named Lumi. I have no affiliation with any of these companies, of course, but that can be helpful. And if you use one, then I would use it for about half an hour and stay within about a meter of it. So that's one point. Next up, if we're moving through the day in chronological order, I would say that you want to keep your caffeine intake as low as possible. For daily caffeine consumption, I generally suggest that people cap their intake at no more than about 3 milligrams of caffeine per kilogram of body mass per day. And what does that mean? Well, if you're a 50 kilo, 20 year old female, then 3 milligrams per kilogram would be 150 milligrams, which is about 2.5 instant coffees or about 1 filter coffee, just to give you an idea of what that corresponds to. And there's a website named caffeineinformer.com that you can use to find out about the caffeine content of commonly consumed foods and drinks like chocolate and coffee and green tea and so on. So check that out, but cap your caffeine intake at that level and keep it as early in the day as possible. People differ a lot in how they metabolize caffeine, but as generic guidance, I generally suggest that people stop consuming caffeine at least 8 hours before their planned bedtime. So if you're planning to go to bed at 10 p.m., then that would be stopping by at least 2 p.m. But the more caffeine that you consume, the earlier that you should stop consuming it. Uh-huh. So that's another one.
And where then, have you found that caffeine really does help? And maybe at what times is it okay to use caffeine that's not going to affect our performance or sleep later in the day?
Yeah. So it's actually very interesting in that there hasn't been that much work looking at the effects of small doses of caffeine consumed early in the day on sleep the following night.
Yeah.
And so it's difficult to say whether small doses early in the day have any effect whatsoever, but certainly I don't think they have big effects. And I also think that you can use caffeine in a smart way to help improve your performance. Mm-hmm. So for cognitive function, doses of 1 to 3 milligrams of caffeine per kilogram of body mass per day will tend to improve numerous different aspects of cognitive function, in particular when somebody hasn't got enough sleep preceding the caffeine consumption. So you'll see improvements in things like mood, reaction time, alertness. Some studies show improvements in working memory too. And then for physical performance, slightly higher doses of caffeine will tend to improve performance in endurance exercise, but also strength and power exercise and intermittent sprint type exercise. And to get those effects, you probably need 3 to 6 milligrams of caffeine. And you probably need higher doses, so something more like 6 milligrams per kilo, to have strong effects on strength training and power performance. Whereas for endurance performance, you might not need quite such high doses. But the optimal dose is, of course, person dependent. And as I mentioned, it's modified by how well rested somebody is. So if somebody's very sleepy because they've only got 4 hours of sleep the night before, then they'll probably benefit from gravitating towards the higher end of that range. But I also think it's a problem when people routinely don't sleep well and then become dependent on caffeine to try and offset the negative effects of that poor sleep. Yeah. So I think use caffeine judiciously. When possible, use it when well rested. If you're an athlete, there's a place for it. If you are a cognitive athlete of sorts and you want to perform really well at work, maybe you're giving a presentation, for instance, then I think there's definitely a place for it on those days too. I just don't think that people should be consuming high doses of caffeine from one day to the next. And there are data showing that when people consume caffeine, they will affect their sleep. So specifically, there was some work recently showing that when people consumed 150 milligrams of caffeine 3 times a day for several days and then removed that caffeine, so they withdrew from consuming any caffeine whatsoever, people were, of course, less vigilant when they withdrew from the caffeine. They were more sleepy and there was more pressure to sleep later in the day. And similarly, there's been some work by Ken Wright's group showing that when people consume caffeine, which is about an amount of caffeine that corresponds to a double espresso shortly before bedtime, they will shift their body's clock later, but also find it harder to fall asleep and reduce the depth of their sleep, yeah, such that their sleep is less restorative. So I think caffeine is a key one, especially for young people too, because I think historically a lot of people in their teens in particular have really warmed to energy drinks and things like that. And then later in the day, I would say that for people who are trying to shift their sleep a bit earlier, as I mentioned before, I think reducing light exposure late in the day can be very helpful, in particular exposure to blue light and green light. And for someone who's trying to shift their clock earlier so they can go to bed earlier, I'd probably begin that reduction in light exposure about 3 hours before planned bedtime. So if someone wants to go to bed at midnight, then they might begin at 9 p.m. And then also another behavior that's very relevant to this particular population is using smartphones and other devices. And there's been a review of all the different scientific research on this published in the last couple of years. And basically what they found was that when people use smartphones, they were, of course, at higher risk of sleeping poorly, but also the people who use smartphones were disposed to depression and anxiety. And it's difficult to say whether that's causal. And there are some data showing that it may be that, for example, young women are more negatively affected by excessive social media consumption than young men are. So there are some modifying factors here at play. But I think that regardless, if people can turn off their smartphones beginning at least an hour before bedtime and get their smartphones out of their bedroom, so maybe leave them in the kitchen, for instance, then they're likely to benefit. And then only turn on the smartphone after they wake up ready for the next day. So that's another key one. And there are probably different ways by which smartphones can disrupt sleep. So one of them is the fact that you've got that exposure to light from the screens. Another is that people might lose track of time and just scroll mindlessly. And another is that the content of the media that they're exposed to through the smartphone might be very stimulating. So if somebody is religiously following their Instagram likes, then maybe that's very stimulating for them. Or if they are reading news about this pandemic, then maybe that causes them lots of concern. Mm-hmm. So that combination of different things, I think, is very helpful. And then I'm going to throw one more thing in the mix, just because this answer clearly isn't already long enough.
Little bonus tip.
Yeah, bonus tip is that if you look at how people respond to light exposure, then, as I mentioned, getting more light exposure early in the waking day and less late in the waking day will tend to shift their body's clocks earlier and hence help them go to bed earlier, fall asleep earlier, and wake up earlier. Interestingly, exercise has similar relationships to the timing of the body's clock. And what that means is that if you follow similar patterns for your physical activity, then you'll have similar effects on the time of your body's clock. So if you exercise within a couple of hours of waking up, then you'll help shift your body's clock earlier. Likewise, if you exercise shortly before bed, then you'll help shift your body's clock later. Mm-hmm. And so for students who have some control over their schedule, so let's say that you just go to the gym because you want to be in shape and you can decide when you go to the gym, then it's probably better to go to the gym in the morning before class or in between classes than it is waiting until after all of your classes are out the way until dinner time to exercise.
Mm-hmm. That's a great tip. Wow. Great tip. I didn't even know that. Is that because of the chemicals that you produce when you're exercising, like cortisol and stuff like this, that if you do it late at night, you kind of block the melatonin secretion? Or
it's probably related to a few things. The carefully controlled experiments that have been done on this have looked at what happens when you control for lots of different things in the environment and you only change the timing at which somebody is doing treadmill exercise. And when you do that, you see that exercise done in the morning or actually around lunchtime will tend to shift somebody's melatonin rhythm earlier. And just for listeners who aren't familiar with melatonin, melatonin is a hormone that's produced by the pineal gland in the brain. And it is a internal signal of darkness in the external world. So while your eyes can recognize when it's light and dark outside, if you think about your liver, for example, then it can't really sense that. And so your body needs its own internal timekeeping signals to tell cells throughout the body when it's the nighttime and therefore to engage in nighttime activities. And melatonin is that hormone that gives that nighttime signal to these different tissues. And so exercise has been shown to independently shift the melatonin rhythm. But at the same time, if you think about what comes with doing physical activity outside of the lab, then there are a bunch of other exposures that are likely to shift the body's clock. So if, for example, you go into the gym beginning 2 hours before your bedtime, then you're going to go into a brightly lit room that's noisy, and those things are inherently somewhat stressful. And then when you couple that with doing intense exercise and the fact that when you do that exercise, you're going to increase your core body temperature and your body's production of various different stress-related hormones like cortisol and adrenaline and noradrenaline that have alerting effects, mm-hmm. all of those different things are going to additively shift your body's clock later. So it's not just melatonin by which exercise is likely having this body clock timing delaying effect. It's all of those different factors, including the actual environment itself.
That's fascinating. Wow.
Yeah, that's crazy. Didn't expect that. I wanted to just wrap it up. I'm sure we want to take too much of your time, but just wanted to start off with where can people reach you?
Sure. They can reach me via my social media accounts. It's probably best to reach out on Instagram. If you send me a direct message at Greg Potter PhD, then I will eventually get back to you. I'm pretty busy at the moment, but I will get back to you in due course. I have a website, which is gregpotterphd.com. haven't updated it for ages, so there's not an awful lot going on there, and I apologize for that. But I would say that if people are interested, they should also check out Resilient Nutrition, and that is resilient with a T, nutrition.com. And on social media, we are at Resilient Nuts on Instagram and Facebook if people want to find out more about our products.
Okay.
Cool.
Drop that in the links.
Yeah. Cool. And we have two wrap-up questions after that. The first one is, it's a bit big. So this is called the Energy Motto Podcast. Upon getting up in the morning, what's one thing that makes you feel alive? In your life, what have you found that ignites that flame within and allows you to tap into your energy, the untapped sources of internal energy that humans hold to unveil innate physical, mental, and spiritual abilities?
Okay.
It's a tough one.
So I will say it is other people, and it's an obvious choice, but I think that a lot of people nowadays feel themselves somewhat socially isolated, and that will impact numerous different facets of their lives in a negative way, including their energy. And I'm relatively introverted, but I still need that type of connection. And I'm very fortunate in that I have a girlfriend who is about the loveliest person who you'll ever meet. And I'm therefore very happy to just hang out with her in the mornings. And she does a good job of brightening my day when I'm feeling a bit bad. So cheesy answer, but I think that at the moment that's very relevant, because a lot of people were feeling socially isolated before this pandemic, but now, because of social distancing and whatnot, people are more isolated than ever. And so doing things to reach out to loved ones and people who you haven't spoken to recently are likely to make you feel a lot better about life and more connected. And that's a human need that we've always had, and which we, I think, increasingly neglect in our modern societies.
Yeah, I love that answer. And it's a great reminder to really take into account that we have people around us that love us, and we have to take the time to reach out and connect. This is the final question that we have, and it's just whatever you want to say. It's your final nuggets of wisdom for anyone that has yet to unleash that internal energy.
Okay. I would say, to come back to something that we discussed earlier, do what you can to reduce your stress and to better cope with stress. And just to add a couple of ideas to that. At the moment, I think that a lot of people are under more financial strain than ever. And if you look at the causes of mental health problems right now, then I think that that is probably near the top of the list, if not at the top. And in 2020, I think it's possible for the powers that be to financially support people in countries throughout the world. Not in all countries necessarily, but concepts like universal basic income have been tested and proven to be effective in many different countries. And I think that there's a stronger need than ever for something like UBI. And while as individuals, we might not feel like we can move the dial in nudging the powers that be to implementing something like UBI, I think that we always have to think globally and act locally, to use a very trite phrase. And what that means is that if there are petitions out there to introduce something like UBI, then if you're under financial strain, then you should get on board with that type of thing. And then otherwise, if you have the means to get rid of avoidable stresses in your life, then you should do so. And maybe one of those is changing your living environment. Maybe you're living in a noisy built up area and you're working remotely, and right now you have the possibility to move elsewhere temporarily to get out of that environment, then I would consider doing that. And we spoke about some stress management practices, but some other ones that I think are very helpful are simple things that are practical pretty much anywhere, like listening to music, listening to relaxing music, especially late in the day. Mm-hmm. But then also I think spending more time in the natural world can be very restorative. And there's been a fair bit of research looking at the effects of time spent in so-called green spaces, but also there's been some looking at the effects of proximity to blue spaces, so the sea and lakes, on people's mm-hmm. health and their mental health in particular. And I think that when people, especially people who live in urban environments, spend a bit more time under trees and on beaches, they're likely to benefit.
For sure, for sure. I agree. I mean, we're living in Madrid, and right now I'm near the ocean, and for me that blue space is key.
I love it.
But hey, thank you so much, Greg. Huh?
I wanted to acknowledge you also. Just this episode has been a library of knowledge. You've been so generous with your time, and thank you so much for really giving us these practical tips. Like, you were just dropping tip after tip after tip that hopefully all of these listeners are going to get a ton of value. So thank you so much for that, and we hope to stay in touch with you.
Yeah, pleasure. Absolute pleasure.
Yes.
Well, thank you, sir.
Thank you so much. Take care.
Take care.
You too.
Damn. As Emilio said, tip after tip after tip indeed. Which ones do you think was the best? Which ones should everyone implement? Let us know on Instagram at The Energy Motto. And don't forget to share this to that person who thinks they're fine sleeping 5 hours a day. Let me know what they respond. Have a good one, guys.